Perhaps no operation better illustrated the tech's derring do than one that took place in the 1970s against an implacable U.S. adversary. After years of futile negotiations to resolve an international dispute with the other nation, the president ordered his closest advisor to initiate secret talks at the highest levels of the foreign government with the objective of ending the conflict. Special assistance from the audio techs was requested for a risky and dangerous operation to acquire information on the intentions and strategy of the foreign negotiators. The techs were chosen for their unusual skills and proven courage in combat. One was an experienced mountain climber. The other, a combat-hardened former Marine, trained for the mission by climbing over slate roofs in his hometown. Working into the early morning hours of a moonless night, a tech, dressed in black, carrying mountain climbing gear, crawled through a window of a safe house onto the steep slate roof of an adjoining building. A few floors below, the other tech waited anxiously with the newly designed audio equipment. When they could move unobserved, the tech skirted several roofs of adjacent houses leading to the residence of the chief of the foreign delegation and crawled silently over its slate tiles. Their targets were three chimneys positioned along the length of the roof's ridge. As they moved from chimney to chimney, into each they dropped a small device called a pinger to measure the length of the fireplace flues that would eventually conceal an audio device. Resembling an oversized pistol, when the pinger reached the upper edge of the fireplace flue, the tech pulled the trigger. A small burst of radio wave energy, like radar, shot down the chimney and bounced back, instantly calculating the distance between the top of the chimney to the desired fireplace location for the bug. With data in hand, the techs retraced their climb and began planning the equally dangerous and risky installation. "We returned a few weeks later, with mics and transmitters the lab had developed," recalled one of the techs. "They were encased in an asphalt bulb, maybe 2 inches in diameter, so when there was a fire in the fireplaces, they wouldn't burn up. Wires, with precise distances based on pinger data, let them lower the devices to the proper length in each chimney before securing them to the top." The audio collection produced transcripts of private strategy discussions held by the target negotiators that were immediately translated and hand-carried to the president's representative to prepare him for the next formal meeting. The techs never saw the transcripts and never expected to. That is the profession. Build the gear, put it in, make sure it works, and get out of the way. Let others use and benefit from the take. Besides, there was no reason to hang around. Other stations had audio ops to be done now. The newly available fractional cubic inch transmitters encouraged planning for aggressive audio operations inside the USSR. Once the CIA had demonstrated that its officers could free themselves from surveillance in Moscow, technical audio operations followed. In the late 1970s, "We were doing things in Moscow that were intentionally below the Soviet radar," remembers a tech. "We were trying to find the balance between high, medium, and low technical operational acts on the street. The capability of the agent, capability for the case officer to meet the agent, capability to dead drop certain sized things. All of that technology we provided the agent. Now we asked, can we bring audio into the mix?" In one of the first operations of its kind in Moscow, a plan was formed to bug one of the police shelters located throughout the city. The small shacks, also set up at strategic points in the foreign embassy district, provided shade and warmth for the police, militia, and KGB surveillance teams as well. The young officers who manned the shacks had duties other than traffic control and maintaining civil order. Their presence was a deterrent to Soviet citizens from contacting foreign officials, because any Russian wandering in the area could be stopped, asked for identification, and questioned about the reason for being there. Equally important for the KGB were the reports from officers in the shacks who relayed the comings and goings of foreign officials to the KGB from these excellent observation posts. As the CIA increased its clandestine contacts inside the USSR through the 1970s, the chief decided to bug one of the shacks. The secret audio could potentially provide valuable intelligence from an officer calling out the movement of diplomats to the KGB surveillance teams and from capturing other security instructions he received. The target shack, which was manned 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, was classically basic. Constructed of wood and roughly twice the size of an old-fashioned phone booth, it contained a small table built into the wall, a telephone, and a heater that offered minimal comfort for two men against the cold of the Russian winter. Over several months, CIA observers noted that the officer in the target shack was often away from his post, across the street talking with a friend. They were able to estimate the size of the small table in the booth and predict the times when the officer took a break for periodic gossip. The operational requirements for the audio device were specific. It needed to be small enough to hide under the table in the shack, large enough to hold enough batteries for extended transmission life, and capable of being installed in less than a minute while the shack was vacant. The techs created a woodblock audio concealment matching the faded color of the wooden table. They set spring-wound screws into one side of the woodblock with enough torque from the spring to secure the block to the table's underside. When the woodblock was placed firmly underneath the tabletop's bottom, the protruding screw heads were depressed, which released springs to turn the screws. Because the bug required so many batteries for power, the woodblock was too long to fit into the briefcase the chief normally carried. This required the techs to create a sling for cradling the device that could be worn under a topcoat. Every day, regardless of weather, the chief wore the topcoat and walked by the shelter, awaiting a time when he could enter unseen, open the coat, kneel down, pull the woodblock out of its sling, put it under the table, and activate the screws. It could all be done in less than 30 seconds. Several weeks passed, with the chief carrying the device each time he walked by the shack. The opportunity finally arose one day as the chief was walking his dog. At a distance, the chief noticed the officer leaving the shelter and crossing the street to talk with a friend, exactly as the operational plan had envisioned. The chief stopped briefly, adjusted the dog's collar, ducked into the empty booth, planted the device, and continued walking. Later that evening, at the nearby listening post, the techs heard and recorded clear audio that was immediately forwarded to Langley for analysis of KGB surveillance codes and techniques. Possibly more important to CIA operations than the intelligence collected from the Little Shack's tapes was the act itself. The CIA had successfully implanted an audio device that clandestinely collected KGB tactical conversations. The small breach of the KGB's internal security wall demonstrated that sound tradecraft, combined with applied technology, could compromise KGB communications. The little audio device became an early indicator of the possibility of future high payoff from technical collection operations inside the USSR. OTS officers who cataloged and analyzed foreign spy gear began to sense a peculiar pattern when it came to Soviet electronic gadgets in the late 1970s. Soviet technology seemed stalled. OTS testing repeatedly showed that the components and performance fell short of the kind of progress seen in Western spy gear. The analysis proved correct. In a 1994 memoir, The First Directorate, the KGB's former counterintelligence chief, Oleg Kalugin, recounted a scene in which Nikolai Yemokonov, the deputy for scientific and technical research, was called on the carpet by then KGB chief and future premier, Yuri Andropov. Andropov reprimanded Yemokonov for lagging behind American espionage technological developments and asked about an OTS transmitter obtained by the KGB. "Well," replied Yemokonov, "we don't have devices this size." "What size have we got?" asked Andropov. "Ours weighs about a kilogram," said Yemokonov. The American device weighed only a few ounces. Everyone in the room knew that the bulky 2-pound Soviet transmitters and receivers were barely suitable for clandestine work. Viktor Cherkashin, a senior KGB officer, offered a similar take regarding OTS audio technology in his memoir published in 2005. Cherkashin recalled that information about U.S. eavesdropping operations inside the USSR simply astounded the KGB when provided by American traitor Aldrich Ames. Cherkashin recounted that at the time of Ames's initial betrayal in 1985, the CIA was juggling several highly complex, technically advanced, ingenious operations inside the USSR without the KGB's knowledge, including eavesdropping devices disguised as tree branches near research installations. On the defensive side, by the mid-1970s, the KGB had developed a significant countermeasures tool, codenamed MAGIC, to detect embedded audio eavesdropping devices. The KGB's first experiment with it, inside their embassy in an Asian country, found more than 24 listening devices, some more than 20 years old, with corroded batteries, hidden throughout the large complex. Called the Nonlinear Junction Detector, NLJD, the device could detect a transistor or integrated circuit inside a clandestine listening device, even when it was not turned on. The nonlinear junction detector worked by setting up a field of energy, radio waves, that read reflected energy. Any circuitry containing a diode present in the field was read as a disruption. Unlike metal detectors, which searched for metallic objects by means of electromagnetic induction, the NLJD was more selective in its search, noticing only the junctions of diodes found in transistors and integrated circuits. It was the beginning of the end for classical embedded audio devices, said Sasha, a former member of the KGB counterintelligence, who claimed the KGB removed hundreds and hundreds of listening devices from each continent. Europe, Canada, Great Britain, United States. Sasha asserted that the KGB presented this nonlinear detector to Cuba, then Warsaw Pact countries, followed by third world so-called friends, such as Iraq, North Korea, and Vietnam. Once the NLJD technology was known, the United States countered with techniques to neutralize its effectiveness. The KGB found that bugs planted near naturally occurring junctions, such as electrical sockets, rusty nails, or sections of walls containing pieces of dissimilar metals touching each other, were a nightmare for detection. Certain components were covered with a variety of hybrid coatings to mask the circuitry within. Improved shielding techniques for audio packages rendered the devices invisible to KGB countermeasures, including the NLJD. We worried a little bit and put additional filters in the circuits to keep the radio frequencies out, said Kurt. We were always trying to shield them anyway, so the extra filtering became an incremental improvement. I don't think we lost many of our devices to nonlinear detection. Once the SRT audio systems were widely deployed, the CIA's capacity to process the take from the hundreds of installations worldwide became a continuing problem. Every audio op required listening post keepers and translators. Although much of the audio contained nothing of intelligence value, someone had to listen to the tape to make that determination. The promise of good intelligence from an audio installation often exceeded the results. I recall, over a 10-year period, 50% of the audio operations were terminated every year, and probably half of those shouldn't have gone forward in the first place, said one senior manager. For a few years, people were getting a feather in their cap because they were involved in an audio op. A case officer felt he really could not be promoted until he had run an audio op. That was part of the case officer checklist. A study done by the same manager concluded that 5% of all audio ops produced 95% of all valuable information, but even that number was tricky. Some compared audio operations to diamond mining. The invaluable gems are found only after sifting tons of dirt. For most of the last 25 years of the Cold War, audio dominated OTS operations. However, the emergence of computer-based information systems and cellular technologies in the 1980s and early 1990s created new target opportunities and eventually lessened the dependence on traditional audio for obtaining private conversations or communications. The target's technology, as well as the person, became an object of recruitment.
This is the end of the CD. The audiobook continues on the next CD.
Chapter 15. Genius is where you find it. The world has arrived at an age of cheap, complex devices of great reliability, and something is bound to come of it. Dr. Vannevar Bush, As We May Think, The Atlantic Monthly, July 1945. Espionage novels and movies devote few pages or minutes of screen time to the scientists and engineers who create spy gear. The notable exceptions are James Bond movies and the British gadget master Q. Acting as the proper British foil to Bond's more colorful persona, Q invariably anticipated Bond's technical needs for each mission, even as he fussed and fretted over each piece of equipment that left his lab. Contrary to Q's uncanny ability to provide Bond with just the right gadgetry, no matter how vague the mission, specific operational requirements preceded the design and deployment of OTS devices. In fact, operational requirements drove much of the innovation, in the same way competition in consumer products pushes companies to the next level of technological sophistication with their products. Noteworthy is the fact that innovation in clandestine gear is motivated not by market share or quarterly profits, but by the need to ensure the survival of agents and officers. This remains as true today as it was for Lovell and the OSS during World War II. Through the decades, the agency had remarkable success in consistently acquiring the required technologies and expertise. By necessity and tradition, OTS sought its devices from a surprisingly wide range of suppliers. Over the years, spy gadgetry has been produced by high-profile business leaders and academics, as well as obscure inventors. CEOs, attracted by a technical challenge and eager to serve their country, set aside manpower and facilities to establish covert technical units. Nobel Prize-winning scientists and internationally recognized engineers have volunteered to work on OTS projects in their off hours. However, big ideas were often the products of the smallest companies with highly specialized expertise. A firm with only a handful of employees was just as likely to turn out an amazing piece of hardware as a multinational with nearly unlimited resources. OTS had long-standing relationships with real garage shop companies. Sometimes they were no more than 10 people. That was the whole company, soup to nuts, including the accountants, said Gene Nehring, an OTS manager. We always kidded about some of our suppliers. Some agency managers would say, "You guys deal with every garage shop around." And yes, we do. And each one did one little thing better than anyone else, anywhere. Perhaps nowhere was this truer than in the case of the T-100 sub-miniature camera, arguably the most productive piece of Cold War spy gear. Developed and manufactured by a tiny company housed in a nondescript industrial park on the eastern seaboard, the film-based T-100 was the ultimate spy camera. Unlike the Minox, which was originally designed and marketed as a commercial product, the T-100's sophisticated optical and mechanical design was so highly specialized and technologically unique, there were virtually no uses for the device outside of espionage. It operated like a point-and-shoot camera, but had no viewfinder and required a painstakingly precise process to hand-load the customized film on its miniature cassette. From design to operation, the T-100 had one function, enabling an agent to take a covert, clear picture of the writing, printing, or diagrams on a piece of paper directly in front of him. Think about it. That camera, as marvelous as it proved itself, was utterly useless as a commercial product, said Gene. It could take a wonderful picture of a single sheet of paper at 11 inches, but it had a depth of field of about 1 inch and no other applications. The T-100's assembly was closer to watchmaking than any commercial manufacturing process. The owner of the company fabricated each camera himself under a large magnifying glass and halo light using a device he built specifically for the task. He had all kinds of things that held the different components in place, explained Gene, who once witnessed the assembly process. It was a real Rube Goldberg apparatus, but it allowed him to take these little tiny things and put them together. Imagine tying a trout fly and performing 10 steps at the same time in three-dimensional space. Because the camera was such a singular device, it offered a high level of operational security. Counterintelligence organizations, after all, cannot guard against a device they do not know exists. However, that same singularity and craftsmanship eventually became a cause for concern. By the late 1970s, with the T-100 proving itself such a valued piece of Cold War spy gear, operational managers grew concerned about future supplies of the camera. With the small company the sole source for the device, and a single individual the only person able to assemble the tiny components, supplies could be jeopardized by something as ordinary as the owner of the company developing a twitch or injuring his hand. The owner, recognizing the vulnerability of a national asset, provided the camera's specifications and engineering drawings to the agency. The complex lens assembly, made up of more than half a dozen elements layered one on top of another, seemed a logical component for second sourcing. One of the premier optical houses in the country seemed the reasonable place to start. "We said, 'Here's a design. What do you think? Can you make this?'" recalled Gene. "Well, they did their computer analysis of the lens and came back to us and said, 'Nope, it won't work. The light won't focus properly. You'll never get a picture out of this thing.' Naturally, we didn't tell them we already had 50 in stock, and they were all working just fine, thank you very much." The potential for another source arose after the agency allowed a friendly intelligence service to borrow some of the prized cameras. Not long afterward, the service requested permission to build its own version. The CIA agreed to share the specs, with the understanding that this overseas production run would become the needed second source. After a few months, the friendly intelligence service returned with the news that they too had failed to duplicate the camera. The inventors themselves could be as unique as the devices they created. One of the stranger meetings Gene remembered was in tracking down an inventor of a new type of long-lasting battery at his upstate New York home. "On a February day, I go flying up there," recalled Gene. "I'm picked up at the airport, and as we're driving out to the house, my colleague says, 'This isn't your ordinary contractor. He's a little eccentric.'" Not knowing what to expect, Gene arrived at the suburban home of the inventor to find him in the backyard digging a trench with a backhoe. After he completed his digging, the inventor jumped on a small bobcat bulldozer and filled the trench in before beginning work on another. The trench, as it turned out, had no specific purpose. Digging holes and refilling them was his hobby. After initial introductions and pleasantries, the inventor invited the two officers to his workshop for a tour. "We went into the cellar, and he had welders, drill presses, all of these tools, and everything said Craftsman on it. It was like walking into a Sears tool department. He had one of everything," Gene said, "and that's where he'd assemble these little batteries by hand, in his basement, with all of these Craftsman tools. But they were one of a kind, and met our needs." Eccentricity was not limited to outside contractors. One of OTS's legendary engineers, Brian Holmes, is remembered as much for his personal style as his remarkable brilliance and creativity. Although Holmes's engineering work was unsurpassed, what drove managers and colleagues to distraction was Brian himself. Every week seemed to bring Holmes another security violation for leaving classified papers in the open or misplacing materials. Invariably, these lapses triggered a broader review of security practices that disrupted the entire division. Brian was a nightmare, a wreck. He barely got his clothes on right, except the son of a bitch got medal after medal for coming up with things that nobody else could make, said Greg Ford, an OTS senior manager. To make matters worse, Holmes's immediate supervisor, a by-the-book administrator, was nearly the exact opposite of the brilliant but disorderly engineer. That the bureaucratic fates had placed this odd couple in such close proximity was either funny, tragic, or both. Finally, at the end of his rope, the supervisor appealed to Ford in the plainest possible terms. He just could not take it anymore. "I had to tell him, 'You're the best division chief I've got, but if I lose you tomorrow morning, I can replace you by the afternoon.' If I lose Holmes, I can't replace him, said Ford. So we have to find a way to deal with this. After giving the problem more thought, Ford hit on a solution. In another part of the OTS complex were several ultra-secure, room-sized vaults built to hold equipment too large for the agency's standard three-drawer office safes. These windowless rooms featured secure steel doors along with good lighting and ventilation. Ford moved Holmes's desk and equipment into one of the cave-like rooms, making it his new office and laboratory. He loved it, absolutely loved it, said Ford. He had all his shit laying around on tables and everywhere else. He knew where everything was. It suited him. And at the end of the day, he didn't need to put anything in a safe. All he had to do was secure the vault door before he left. Naturally, I'd always have someone else check on it. For Ford, the untidy Holmes fell into that rare and precious category of engineers he labeled inventive bastards. A valued asset, they were aggressively recruited and then given enough freedom to work their magic. Let me put it that way. If I had 100,000 Chinese, 100,000 Russian, and 100,000 American engineers, there's going to be about 150 of these creative types in each group, said Ford. One of my jobs was to find and convince them to work for OTS, and then protect them. Finding, retaining, and protecting these engineers and scientists became an obsession for Ford and the agency. After World War II, and throughout the Cold War, the value of technology to intelligence operations steadily increased as devices grew smaller, more portable, and concealable. Science, as a vital arm of intelligence, is here to stay. We are in a critical and competitive race with the scientific development of the Soviet bloc, particularly that of the Soviet Union, and we must see to it that we remain in a position of leadership, wrote Alan Dulles in the early 1960s. Someday this may be as vital to us as radar was to Britain in 1940. Others shared Dulles's assessment of technologies important to espionage and warfare, including MIT professor Dr. Vannevar Bush. During World War II, Bush served as chairman of the National Defense Research Committee, NDRC, the organization into which Lovell was recruited and from which OTS would eventually emerge. Even as the war was winding down, Bush was thinking ahead. Looking toward the future, he authored a seminal essay on science and engineering, As We May Think, which appeared in the July 1945 issue of the Atlantic Monthly. His insights would prove prophetically accurate. The world has arrived at an age of cheap, complex devices of great reliability, and something is bound to come of it, Bush wrote. Consider a future device for individual use, which is a sort of mechanized private file and library. It needs a name, and to coin one at random, Memex will do. A Memex is a device in which an individual stores all his books, records, and communications, and which is mechanized so that it may be consulted with exceeding speed and flexibility. It is an enlarged intimate supplement to his memory. In the first decade of the 21st century, Bush's Memex could be called the personal computer, though elements of his predictions would eventually turn up in cell phones, PDAs, notebook computers, and even the Internet, all of which serve as supplements to our memories. In a second paper, this one written for President Roosevelt that same year, titled Science, the Endless Frontier, a Report to the President, Bush argued that science is a vital resource of the United States in peacetime and war. It has been basic United States policy that government should foster the opening of new frontiers. It opened the seas to clipper ships and furnished land for pioneers. Although these frontiers have more or less disappeared, the frontier of science remains. It is in keeping with the American tradition, one which has made the United States great, that new frontiers shall be made accessible for development by all American citizens. The quandary the agency faced from the 1950s onward was in identifying applicable new technologies and recruiting the right engineers and scientists. This was no easy task. Men and women with technical skills were becoming highly valued, emerging as the superstars of the post-World War II generation. At Bell Labs, they designed transistors and then integrated circuits. Xerox revolutionized computing by transforming an obscure government-funded project into the first computer with a mouse and graphical interface. Plastics and synthetic materials, jet engines, and televisions were making industrial engineers wealthy and changing the way